Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy. I wanted to begin. I mean, there was madness across America's college campuses yesterday, particularly the elite universities, particularly the East Coast elite universities. But of course, a lot of people are very worried about Brotherly Spice's kid who was suspended from Barnard. $100,000 a throw there.
Yeah. Do you see my tweet about her? This woman, this kid, rich kid. Don't cry. Her family is very well off. She has a home and a bed in Minnesota or D.C. that she can go to and sleep in and get fed, okay?
Well, a lot of people are worried about her because she's homeless, and they were busting up that encampment where they were having communal meals and so forth. So you just want to make sure that she's okay. She was able to muster the strength, despite malnourishment, to appear on MSNBC to talk about the protesting that she and her cohorts are engaged in at Columbia and the Seven Sisters. And here's what she had to say about that.
Yeah, I guess I was suspended Thursday morning at 10 a.m. with two other fellow Barnard students. The email stated that we had engaged in disruptive behavior, but had not outlined the code of conducts that we had violated. The three of us were the only three that had done public interviews at that point. And so we think that our targeting or the reason we got suspended so early was due to the fact that we had made ourselves known. And then that the school got NYPD records to be able to arrest the rest of the students. How I'm feeling about it, however, I think a little bit, like, this was expected. We all knew that we knew the risks and we knew what we were engaging in. However, I wasn't really expecting to be immediately locked out of my dorm, of dining, of campus as quickly as I was.
Oh, yeah. No, I hope she got her meal card.
And I think it's what she really misses even more than quality food at Barnard is the camaraderie of encampment living on Columbia University's campus.
I mean,
I think that the encampment was honestly one of the beautiful forms of solidarity. We would be singing songs. We had meals together. People prayed together. They held Shabbat yesterday. And it's really just been a very community-centered space. And also because of the fact that it is outside, it hadn't disrupted any classes and had really been a very isolated kind of moment where the zone in which we were actually protesting in is the demonstration zone that we are allowed to technically be able to protest in. And so the school had already placed this spot to be a place that is meant for this, these kind of actions, and therefore shouldn't have be seen as disruptive.
If only we could scale all of America's society to be as harmonious as these encampments on Ivy League campuses. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Maybe they can become pen pals, you know, the people that she met in the encampment, just like they did on Martha's Vineyard. Remember with the migrants when they were there for 32 minutes?
Well, she's suspended, but she hasn't been returned to another country. She's still in New York.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I've been camping. I don't think you look much like a camper. But you've gone fishing and stuff, but those tents that they set up, who bought those tents? Those are expensive. And the food that they brought, like, who's sponsoring this? Does anybody we should follow the money trail, cuz
it's not that hard to follow. We'll get to, you know, some of the sponsoring organizations and the professional agitators, just as was the case with the Black Lives Matter rioting and disruptions that occurred and violence that occurred in the summer of 2020. This seems to be a parallel situation with the autonomous zones and the whole thing, all the features.
Back to the rich girl who's homeless and hungry. Sorry.
Well, but before, I mean, I just want to, you know, make sure we give her a fair airing while she is frozen out of Barnard. She has some demands.
Oh.
And I think if Barnard maybe sort of the larger college community would meet her very reasonable demands, and we could put this ugliness behind us.
Yeah, our three demands are divesting or asking Columbia University to divest from all companies that are complicit in genocide and actually have a hand in genocide, as well as transparency of Columbia's investments. These are not public information, as well as amnesty for all students that are actively being repressed and that were also suspended due to these pro-Palestinian protests.
Students like you, for example. Yes.
Mom's proud of her, by the way. She tweeted out, "I'm enormously proud of my daughter. She's always led with courage and compassion, Dan, from organizing a statewide school walkout on the 20th anniversary of Columbine at the age of 15 to leading the biggest youth climate rally at our nation's capital at 16.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a proud moment. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you raise kids, as I understand it, and you worry, like, are they going to carry on the family name, the family traditions, the family belief systems, and you don't know. Is my daughter Isra, is she going to be the virulent anti-Semit that I have spent my life being? And good news for mom, the answer is a resounding yes. So not to worry, she is on the path. Yeah, no, she will be an obnoxious, ignorant, outspoken anti-Semite, just like dear old mom. By the way, some people who are wondering, is Isra the offspring of the brotherly love situation there with Ilhan?
So is her dad also her uncle is what you're asking?
Right. And the answer is no, no. The Isra came before Ilhan Omar started using Ancestry.com as a dating app.
Oh.
So that came after.
Hey-o.
Thank you.
My tweet actually was, rich girl saying she's homeless and hungry is an insult to those who are truly homeless and hungry.
Yeah, well, who's really hungry in America? Yeah. I mean, it's just that's one of these things that we say. And unless you're mentally ill and not being tended to and you don't have the capacity to access food pantry, shelter, so on and so forth, it just doesn't happen. But I get the point. I get the point. I mean, it was, by the way, it's nice because all these Ivy Leaguers – and the denizens of these elite universities, the undergrads here, these are our best and brightest, the greatest minds that America and the world over really produces on an annualized basis.
Yes.
And they seem to be sharing a brain. Now, this could also have something to do with that most of these Ivy League undergrads are the products of generations of inbreeding. So I don't know if that how much that has to do with it. Certainly a factor. Anyway,
get an email on that one.
Well, you know, I mean, I just say everyone.
Okay.
Just most. I thought that was very measured. First of all, over at MIT, they've moved into the pickle bucket phase of the protesting, which is a dangerous phase.
Uh-huh.
And it's not the fun pickle buckets like outside of Soldier Field. I think you're starting to pick up what they're laying down. They have four demands, too, and they're eerily similar to the three demands that Ursa Omar, I guess her technically her last name is Isra Hersey, Omar's kid. Anyway, the four demands, MIT students for their version of Students for a Free Palestine, and here they are.
We've shown our administrators the power that we hold, and we can't give it up. We are the ones who run this campus, who make the campus what it is. Mm. We hold the power, so we have to show them that we won't back down until they meet our demands.
My name is Hannah. I'm with the Coalition for Palestine at MIT, and right behind us is our Scientists Against Genocide encampment. Following in Columbia's footsteps, we are in an encampment in solidarity with Gaza, and all the Boston area schools have a set of four demands. The first one is to disclose investments. The second is to cut ties with the IOF. Third is to call for a ceasefire. And fourth is to drop charges against students. And we're here in solidarity with our siblings in Gaza as well as our siblings in Colombia.
Our siblings, our political siblings. I guess Israel left out the demand for a call for ceasefire. And she's going to have to retake the indoctrination class, it would seem. But anyway, so that's where it is. And I know maybe people are looking at this and say, oh, gosh, I'm old enough to remember the 60s and, you know, our protestations over this and that and the summers of love and free sex and joy and following the Grateful Dead around and whatnot. Yeah, and that's just this version of it. I think this is a little bit more noxious strain of protesting the establishment than perhaps previous iterations. As I said, I mean, it's very similar to Black Lives Matter. It's overtly Marxist. It is anti-American. It is anti-peaceful pluralism. It not only condones, as we'll talk about in a bit, it advocates for violence.
Right. Death to America, death to Israel. They're spitting on Jewish people. They're not letting them into these autonomous zones. They're stabbing Miss Israel with a Palestinian pole in her left eye. And all of this is happening at Passover, which really, you know, makes it even all that more disgusting.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
First with Sebastian Gorka, weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're talking about the Pitt protesters who have Royal College campuses, the pro-Islamist terrorist protesters. Pitt, got to have an acronym.
Okay.
That's what they're turning America into if we're not careful. And one of the baby-faced jihadists who has emerged as faces of these Pitt protesters is none other than Isra Hirsi, the daughter of brotherly love spice Ilhan Omar. The Barnard students, she goes to Barnard, $100,000 a year.
It's unbelievable amount of money.
Her colleagues, her fellow oppressed undergrads at Barnard, have rallied for her. It's pretty inspired stuff. They're pushing the president of Barnard, where they're going to occupy the administrative offices and stuff, very 60s. But President Rosenberry, they have a message for you on behalf of their imprisoned, their exiled colleague, compatriot, brotherly love spices kid.
No suspensions. Now.
What do we want?
No suspensions.
Rosenberry.
Now. Rosenberry.
When are coming?
Now.
Who are coming for?
Rosenberry.
When are coming?
Now. No suspensions.
They're coming for Rosenberry now, and they better, she better, or he better agree. MIT's president. No, Barnard president. I don't know if it's a man or woman. I mean, okay. Could be a man identifying as a woman,
we
vice
don't
versa.
Use gender, Stan, please.
Who knows? I mean, Barnard is a school for strictly for lesbian Marxists anyway, so I assume that it's some sort of female. Anyway, yeah, so this is what's going on at Barnard. What's going on at Columbia? Barack Obama's alma mater.
Yeah, don't you know?
Well, I'm surprised he hasn't interceded. Maybe call for a beer summit. That'd be helpful. At Columbia.
They canceled classes yet. Well, they had remote learning because it was too. A rabbi suggested no Jewish students could go to school. It's not safe. So we don't know if that's continuing today, but now they are rethinking graduation. So they might have a virtual graduation instead of an in-person graduation.
Well,
it just harkens back to COVID. COVID and anti-Semitism both end up in remote learning.
I mean, I think you have a graduation for the baby-faced jihadists and then a graduation for everybody else. Well, anyway, so a Jewish student was in and around the perimeter of the encampment at Columbia. And, of course, these pit protesters, these pro-Islamist terrorist protesters, had to scramble quickly to protect the perimeter, make sure that no Zionist incurred into their encampment. Just listen to this. Remember, this is Columbia University, Ivy League, supposedly the best and brightest, I say again. And this is how they respond to the presence of a Jewish student at their little encampment party.
Attention, everyone. Can I get everyone to form a human chain right here, please?
We have Zionists that have entered.
My check! My check! Repeat after me.
We have me.
We have Zionists.
We have Zionists.
Who have entered the camp.
Who have entered the camp.
We are going to create a human chain.
We are going to create a human chain.
Where I am standing.
Where I am standing.
So that.
They do not pass this point.
And infringe upon our privacy.
And infringe upon our privacy.
And try to disrupt our community.
And try to disrupt our community.
Please join me in this chain.
You see how hostile this is? And you're asking me not to record?
Walk and take a step forward.
Yeah, I absolutely feel threatened.
Take a step forward.
So that we can.
So that we can.
Start to push them.
Out of the camp.
One step forward. Another step forward.
Why would that Jewish student feel threatened that there is a mob of people chanting the same thing like some lobotomized cult and moving to push him out of whatever they've defined as their encampment? Why would anybody feel threatened by that Children of the Corn routine that they were just doing?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
How do you like that?
Oh, that is just creepy.
It is. I mean, it's something out of a horror movie. You know, killer cults. Well, that's what Islamofascism is.
Right.
It's a killer cult. That's what Hamas is. It's a death cult. And apparently that's what some Columbia students are buying into. And it's not just Columbia, as we were saying. MIT, University of Michigan, I saw they feature an encampment now. Berkeley.
Yeah, and Northern. Yeah, other UC, Santa Cruz, I believe, too. But what happened to Columbia, the kids that were, and I mean kids, that were arrested on Friday were released without being charged. So
well,
they're
going
to keep doing it. So they're just going straight back to the encampment. And then they cleared out the encampment last night. Now they're already trying to build it back up.
Well, of course they did. I mean, the police busted up. It was mayhem on the campus of NYU where police busted up the encampment. So they're arresting people. I mean, this just gives you a little flavor of the scene. You know, police are trying to move them out, and then they fall on the ground, and they start screeching and free Palestine and so on and so forth. But anyway, right, don't forget who the prosecutors are in New York City. I mean, of course they're going to be released.
And please excuse me, where were they where they were hitting the cops on the head with large water bottles and sticks because they occupied a building and they were trying to get in? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, pick an Ivy League campus, any Ivy League campus. For anybody, everybody who thought that, oh, Claudine Gay and the Penn professor being felled by their testimony before a congressional committee, that really sent a message that reverberated through the Ivy League. Oh, really? How about now?
Looks like
you think you still think so?
Yeah, it looks like an insurrection to me.
It's just the nature of this. Now, by the way, this is a actually, before we get to that, I liked what. Palantir CEO Alex Karp had to say. He had a message to, I think, this group specifically, but I don't think it's limited to these groups that we're discussing. I think it's just timely. Karp is the CEO again, Palantir, the big VC firm, Peter Thiel and Joe Lonsdale and so forth. He's a billionaire. By the way, Palantir, you know where that name comes from?
I don't.
You have to be a real dork appreciate
a dork.
It.
I just hang out with one. Oh,
yeah, exactly. Palantiri, the seven stones from Lord of the Rings.
They're
dorks too. They're dork billionaires. That's what separates them from me. Anyway, Alex Karp has a message to the young jihadists.
I am not a legislator, but I am running one of the coolest companies in the world. And I'm telling young people, you are breathing the vapors of a dangerous, new, fake, and self-destructive religion when you are sitting at your elite school pretending because you watched TikTok twice and got an A+ on some crazy paper because your professor couldn't get a job anywhere else, that you actually understand the world. And you're not welcome at my company.
Yeah.
Wow. And Robert Kraft, former New England Patriots, he's vowed to stop donating to Columbia University.
Yeah, what took him so long?
I don't know.
That's the same thing we say, you know, same thing. This is redux. This is the testimony, congressional testimony from the Ivy League presidents and the MIT president. And then, oh, Bill Ackman makes a big show. I'm not donating to Harvard anymore. I'm not hiring kids from Harvard. Ken Griffin does the same thing, you know, after they're $500 million in. I mean, okay, fine. You turned off the spigot. Good for you. What took you so long? Robert Kraft, where have you been? What have you been paying attention to?
You know, Ken Griffin did it months ago. And I really want you to meet Danielle Simons. She's a Jewish student at Columbia University. You would love what she did. She was active in trying to find out what really is going on.
After October 7th happened, I went around to pretty much every single person I saw wearing a kufiya on campus, and I asked to have a conversation. I invited them to come get coffee with me. And most of them said, I'm sorry, I'm not the right person for that. I don't know enough about the conflict. I don't actually, I'm just here in solidarity with my Palestinian brothers and sisters, they would say to me, or they would just refer me to Al Jazeera if I wanted more information. I remember one notable time, there were a couple of students that were selling kufiyas, and so I asked them, like, hey, like, what's the symbolism of the kufiya for Palestinian people? And they had nothing to say to me. They handed me a pamphlet. It's so sad.
That's what they did. They handed her a pamphlet.
Yeah, right. What is new about this? I mean, it's like, I mean, she's a kid, but where's everybody been? What was it during Black Lives Matter? Do you think that people that were out under the color of Black Lives Matter engaged in peaceful protesting or less than peaceful protesting? Knew the manifesto that Black Lives Matter had posted on its website with the destruction of the nuclear family and the other updated tenets of Marxism? Of course not. Where does this come from? It's organized. And these skulls full of mush, to borrow from Rush, are perfect fodder for the useful idiots, for the messengers that the Islamofascists need. And need to utilize in the West.
Kids are Bill doing McGurn, it because it's cool. Yeah.
Well, it's more than that. Bill McGurn has a good column in the Wall Street Journal about who's behind the anti-Semitic pro-terrorist protests. As early as a decade ago, during the July-August 2014 Israel-Gaza war, Hamas's interior minister issued guidelines to social media activists on framing events for a Western audience. It's no coincidence that official statements by Hamas and major jihadist groups about the protests are nearly identical. The statements seem like talking points for pressuring U.S. and Western decision makers. They appear to be working. You know, obviously, we see the Biden administration's fork-tonguedness on all of this. A good example of what McGurn is talking about, came, the jihadist talking points came from Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah on March 13th when he lauded the political activity of American Muslims in Michigan as very influential. He said of the many people demonstrating in America that we should salute them and call the uncommitted primary campaign against Mr. Biden, which originated in Dearborn, the most important means of pressure on the Biden administration. So there's some of it, and there's other examples that he goes through. This is coming literally from Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, the Iranians as the one of the major underwriters of all of the above. It's coming directly from people who are real pros at this, real pros at using violence towards political ends.
Very organized.
The students, we've mentioned this before, the Students for Justice in Palestine, where you have these campus chapters all over the country. There's links to terrorist organizations funding these campus groups.
Oh, okay. There, right.
October 7th attacks. Here's the statement, Students for Justice in Palestine. You just heard, we played a clip from, I think it was MIT, a representative of the chapter of the SJP, the Students for Justice in Palestine. This was their response to the October 7th terrorist attacks. Liberation is not an abstract concept. It is not a moment circumscribed to a revolutionary past as it is often characterized. Rather, liberating colonized land is a real process that requires confrontation by any means necessary. In essence, decolonization is a call to action, a commitment to the restoration of indigenous sovereignty. It calls upon us to engage in meaningful actions that go beyond symbolism and rhetoric. Resistance comes in all forms, armed struggle, general strikes, popular demonstrations. All of it's legitimate. All of it is necessary. Well, armed struggle is violence. All of it is legitimate. All of it is necessary. It's targeting. I mean, they're talking about targeting Jewish people, wherever you are, including on the campus at Columbia or Harvard or MIT or Michigan or Berkeley.
Yeah, I don't think it's safe for them to go to school today. I'm going to find out if they're going to do remote learning again.
Jonathan Chait even goes deeper into this, even though he's sort of a, well, he's just an obnoxious leftist simp for all of these illiberal forces, but he's trying to, it's like a lot of these left-leaning billionaires, he's trying to write this, he writes this piece in New York Magazine as sort of a way to distance himself from some of the ugliness that he otherwise essentially facilitates. Another group to look for is Within Our Lifetime. Like Students for Justice in Palestine, Within Our Lifetime takes an uncompromising eliminationist stance toward Israel, calling for the abolition of Zionism. Chait writes, if you suspect it would be difficult to exterminate an idea peacefully, you are correct. WOL, Within Our Lifetime, endorses all violent attacks on Israeli Jews. We defend the right of Palestinians as colonized people to resist the Zionist occupation. There's that phrase again, by any means necessary. Tony, Southside.
Good morning, Amy Lamb. And with all due respect and admiration, Dan the Dork.
Yeah, thank you. Listen, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You didn't know what Palantir was referencing, did you?
Palantir, it's the word of the day, folks.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate the education. However, I've been on this mud ball for a long time, and I've seen a lot of protests over the years. Now, here's what's fascinating. That hokey-pokey, left foot in, left foot out kind of chant that these guys were doing sounded like something from a sitcom, okay? Now, if any other CEOs outside of Kraft and all these other billionaires don't recognize that they cannot hire these people, well, we're all lost in this world. That's all I want to say.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Oh. Yeah. I mean, it does sound like from a sitcom, but it also sounds from like Heaven's Gate or a Scientology conference.
Dan, Columbia University has announced that they're going hybrid till the end of the spring semester.
Well,
professors holding classes or hybrid or not, where hybrid is not optional, we're asked to consider remote participation or provide other accommodations.
Hmm.
Oh boy, virtual learning. Where have we seen this before?
Well, no one should be safe until Brotherly Love Spices kid is unsuspended from Barnard. That would be a nice olive branch.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Matt, Mount Greenwood.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's no wonder why over the course of time millions of people have gone to the slaughter without a fight. It's just, I can't believe the stupidity and ignorance of these people. But You know, one nice thing, if they get really, really upset, if they all drink the Kool-Aid one day, you know, if they couldn't handle it on this mud ball any longer, if they all drink the Kool-Aid, it'd be a great day for the humanity. Have a good day.
Oh, no.
Thanks for the call, Matt. I'm sure he's being that, you know, metaphorically.
Right, I know, but we know how that ends.
Poorly for the Kool-Aid drinkers, right?
Jimmy Jones?
Well, here's the thing, too. Right. Jim Jones.
Thank you. Yeah, oh, that right. movie just freaked me out.
You may refer to him as Jiminy. I don't know what your relationship was, but sounds
we
very...
We weren't in a cult, no. But I remember that whole, just being glued to the TV going, what in the world is going on?
Well, you know, Tony from the South Side, he makes a good point about these people with their shiny credential from an Ivy League or a Seven Sister or an MIT. Mm-hmm. Probably get plum jobs in corporate America. Maybe less so. Maybe there's more. People like Alex Karp paying more attention, maybe. But if not, in corporate America, where they get paid a lot, they can get paid a lot to be an automaton in the media. You don't need to innovate. Like, you don't need to be a coder or a software developer or a finance whiz. You can just be somebody that reads the talking points. You can be, you know, photogenic enough to read the talking points for big money. And then you can be one of these people.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But we are concerned about
plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish the same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and
false news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media
It's a soft landing for all those Columbia students, isn't it?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy updating the details on the murder of Chicago police officer Luis Huesca. As you heard of Mike Scott's newscast, police now have, it's alternatively being reported a person of interest and a suspect. I'm guessing it's more likely a suspect. This a video image of a black man in a convenience store near the shooting, near where Officer Huesca was murdered, and just a few minutes before he was murdered, police want to identify and talk to this person. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's online.
Yeah,
everywhere
we'll tweet
now.
It out because there's two different clips. He's walking into this convenience store multiple times, wearing once a black puffy jacket with the hood up, but he has glasses on. He has a slight mustache. He doesn't have AirPods. He's got the old-fashioned, you know, with string that leads to the your iPhone headset on. He's, you know, and then there's another picture of him wearing black jeans and a different, like a gray sweatshirt. They recovered the SUV, but the officer's weapon is still missing, and part of his uniform is missing. That's what my source told me yesterday.
His badge was taken too.
Right.
But one thing that has not changed is Brandon Johnson's position. He's been pressed since ShotSpotter first alerted police to the shooting. Part of this discussion has been, well, now maybe you should rethink ending the contract with ShotSpotter, even as he tried to end it last year and then extended it at a premium through the DNC, at least. And by the way, given the autonomous zones on college campuses around the country right now and the sort of violence that is being advocated and sometimes being exhibited, I can only imagine how it will play out in just a couple of months in Chicago at the DNC when all of these maladjusted young jihadists financed by professional jihadists descend on Chicago. It should be very interesting. But on the point of ShotSpotter,
yes,
Brandon Johnson, our police department has the tools that it needs to help us build a stronger, safer Chicago. As I've said repeatedly, it can't be done with policing alone. That is a failed strategy. It's a failed strategy. Some older humans disagree with him, but that's what he's saying. And then he said about Huesca's murder, we're going to release the full force of government to bring these people to justice.
He went on to say yesterday that, you know, he spent time with Huesca's mom and uncle, and it was the hardest thing he ever had to do. And he's a mayor of the people, and he's here for the people, and we're going to stop this kind of crimes. Yeah, by doing what? And ShotSpotter, all the aldermen want is to have their discretion in their own ward. You know, like I know Alderman Lopez, he wants ShotSpotter in his ward. He said, and this was a great example of how the ShotSpotter alerted authorities to this 5 whole minutes before 911 was called.
Somewhat. No. Alderman Lopez is wrong. No. If you think that just continuing the feudal system under which Chicago operates is acceptable, that's not acceptable. I just want it in my ward. No.
It's either
for the city or it's not for the city. It either makes sense everywhere or it doesn't. This is not federalism. I mean, it's feudalism. That's what it is. That's how Chicago actually operates. And I'm done indulging that. Either you're going to put together a fight on this one little thing, is sort of like the sugar tax. This one little thing on public safety, just like the sugar tax, was this one little thing about usurious taxation in Chicago. And you're going to draw a line and you're going to fight and you're going to challenge your defund, decarcerate colleagues, put pressure on them to relent and say, yeah, ShotSpotter everywhere because it's a benefit to policing everywhere. And so every resident of Chicago deserves that benefit, should have that benefit. Not I pick it and you don't. No. That's the way to play it. What we were talking about yesterday, this has to stop. This is going to stop. We heard that after the Danny Golden shooting. We heard that after Ella French. We heard that after Arianna Preston. And we're hearing the same thing now after Luis Huesca. So what is it you're willing to do in furtherance of stopping this or curbing it? Nobody can make it stop completely. But, you know, curbing it, doing something to change how things operate in reality, on the ground, with police, with residents in the city of Chicago, under the rule of law. What is it that you're willing to do or willing to advocate be done? Not just for me, my ward. No.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
When is it time to go big in Chicago? Please, sir. Spare a cup of tea. When is it time to go big?
Go heavy or go home? I don't know. Now? It's only going to get worse. August is what you guys. August is right around the corner, and the presidential election is less than 6 months away.
When is it time to say, let's reestablish what the baseline is here? This is going to be a city that serves the law-abiding. Instead of a city that literally, we've moved beyond condoning, that serves the criminal at the expense of the law-abiding. Criminals, foreign and domestic, at the expense of the law-abiding. Is that a baseline where we can get some general agreement that that is not the way to operate a city? Because everything flows from the first principles you set forth. And that's why you're saying, I can't understand why BLM Brandon is promoting this, and I can't understand that, scratching your head all the time. Or, you know, people that don't pay attention like our listeners do. Well, explain it to me. I don't get it. What is he doing? Do you listen? Direct people to listen to what they say, to understand the baseline they're starting from. Because if you understand the premise, then you can predict where they're going to go in conclusion. And the premise is this is a city for people who do not play by the rules because they have. And of course, there's a rationale because they are oppressed. And so we're rewriting the rules to serve the oppressed and the privileged will finance this and otherwise endure it. And the oppressed are people who are in prisons and people who commit crimes and people who come into this country illegally and people who demand that you pay their student loan debt and you pay for other decisions they make, good, bad or otherwise. If you start from that premise, it all comes into focus, doesn't it? What's happening? Did you see this story in the NPR Times? CTA touts his second chance program for ex-offenders, but few end up with permanent jobs. This is like an expose on the CTA second chance programs because, of course, it's hailed by these race hustlers, these identitarians, these new Marxists. This is the way we're going to provide opportunities to the ex-offender community, reintegrate them to society, and so on and so forth. And I'm all for programs like that, that are actually successful and whose first principles are identifiable and it makes sense that they're going to get people somewhere. Like we always use John Ponder's Hope for Prisoners program in Clark County, Nevada, because it's one of the best in the country. If you want to really get into reducing recidivism and turning people who have done bad things into people who are doing good things now and being people who play by the rules with their second chance, that's one thing. But that's not what's happening here because these programs aren't set up to do that. These programs are set up to check a box, to have a bullet point on a campaign flyer, to blare from the fifth floor, ex-offenders getting second chances and CTA and this and that. We've got an apprentice program. 14% of those in the apprentice program found permanent full-time employment with the CTA a year after. I mean, not to mention the CTA has never been solvent. It's not solvent now. Its ridership is down. I don't know where the expectation is that you're going to just manufacture jobs out of thin air to do anything other than clean up the pools of blood on the CTA and the CTA platforms. And the story is just replete with people complaining about what the CTA didn't give them. Well, you know, when you've got a felony conviction on your record, you're going to have to work extra hard to reintegrate into civilized society. You lost the benefit of the doubt. I hate to break it to people. But instead, we have an entitlement mentality created by politicians who say that, no, you have this, you were incarcerated, you have this felony conviction because of white supremacy, because you're oppressed, because you're marginalized, and so we're going to reorder society for your benefit. It's happening everywhere. Listen to this report out of CBS, and right, nationally, I mean.
Right.
Listen to this report out of Pittsburgh, a CBS affiliate reporting this. Sheetz, the convenience store chain.
Oh, that's where Biden went in and nobody cared. And people actually wouldn't even go up to him and take pictures. He was trying to pull a Trump and just, you know, spontaneously go into a fast food convenience store place. And
yeah, well, the EEOC cares about it. They're watching.
Sheetz is being sued over its hiring practices. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed the suit this morning. It claims that the way Sheetz bases employment on criminal records disproportionately screens out Black, Native American, and other multiracial applicants, and that this violates federal law. The suit does not accuse Sheetz of being motivated by race when making hiring decisions. We have reached out to Sheetz for comment, but so far we have not heard back.
Was that political payback because Sheetz didn't fill the restaurant up with Biden supporters?
No, this happened well before that. And obviously there was an investigation ongoing, the phony investigation, so that you could come up with this phony case. So understand. So this convenience store operation out east is being sued by the EEOC, so essentially the Department of Justice,
right,
for civil rights violation, you know, under anti-discrimination law, because they're refusing to hire ex-cons at rates that would provide the requisite diversity of their workplace, or the desired diversity. So they're saying, we're not hiring ex-cons, and because a disproportionate share of ex-cons are minorities, that is de facto discrimination. Racial. Sheetz didn't set up the justice system, and Sheetz isn't responsible for any of the crimes and any of the people who apply for jobs they're committed. But they're the discriminators being sued by the federal government. So that's how the left wants to wire the entire country. And that's what you're seeing in Chicago as well. So you want to have the conversation at the root cause, at the root level. Well, there it is. And so everything that Brandon Johnson and Tony Preckwinkle and most of the city council does, Jelly Belly too, although he's a little bit less ideological about it. But it comes from, are we on the path? Are we on that path from whence we started? Traveling down the road, we want to take the city, the county, the state, the country. It's not about ShotSpotter. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Tucker Carlson's sit down with Joe Rogan for Rogan's podcast is getting a lot of attention. And, you know, generally I like Tucker, though I disagree with him on some things. He was nice enough to have me on his show on Fox a couple of times when when he was there. And so I just used that as some backstory. But some of the things that he's, I would say, given into, he would probably say rethought. A little troubling. You know, I understand from whence some of it comes, and he explained it, actually, what we have learned over the last 7 or 8 years since Trump's arrival on the scene, what we have seen from our government is disturbing. And, you know, as the sort of saying goes these days, you know, conspiracy theories are just foreshadowing. Yeah, right. A lot of things you didn't think were possible that people suggested were afoot or could be afoot or were coming have indeed come to pass. But that is not cover to sort of have a knee-jerk response to say anything that you see or hear is to be immediately disregarded. You're to take the 180-degree position away from the official story automatically. Without consideration, thought, evidence. Whatever they say, I believe the opposite. Well, that's not very intellectually robust, is it? You'll see where I'm going in a second. First, Tucker Carlson on his essentially watershed moment in 2017.
Probably unlike you, I didn't have any opinions like that. I was like, fluoride, come on. You know, 9/11, shut up! Yeah. UFOs, you're f***ing crazy. You know what I mean? I just, like, I had this reflexive, I'm ashamed of it. I'm not bragging about it. But it was 2017, and really it was the Trump campaign. It wasn't that I was, like, so in love with Trump, though I've always liked Trump because, you know, he's, like, hilarious and charming and all that. But I wasn't, like, a Trumper or anything. But it was watching that campaign and particularly his claim that they were spying on him. And I was like, really? The intel services and federal law enforcement, FBI, do not spy on presidential campaigns. Like, that's so out of the realm. That's so crazy. Like, that could never happen because, of course, there's no democracy in a system like that. And fundamentally, we're a democracy, an imperfect one. It kind of lumbers along, you know, but, like, it's not fake. And then that turned out to be true, and I knew it was true. And that just blew my mind. So I began a process still ongoing of reassessing a lot of other things. Like, okay, well, if that was not true, what else is not true? And what else that they told me was a conspiracy theory might actually have some basis in fact? And so
that led to discussions like Building 7 was a controlled demolition and the possibility 9/11 was an inside job. You know, Charlie Sheen world, as it were. It also led to a characterization of the deep state taking down Nixon. You know, going back more than five decades now to Watergate, which, when you know, speaking of spying on presidential campaigns, the committee to elect the president was intending to do that on the McGovern operation, right? So, I mean, there's been these abuses of power that predate the modern era or current times, not to the extent of the weaponization. I think the Obama years were a watershed moment in the weaponization of intelligence agencies. What Holder and Brennan and Hayden and Clapper and Obama did. That's a watershed moment. We can get into that. But going back, so insinuating the possibility of 9/11 being an inside job, which is what he did on that Rogan podcast, saying this about the plumbers and Watergate.
I mean, if you look at what happened to Richard Nixon, which I, of course, did not understand at all, Richard Nixon was taken out by the FBI and CIA and with the help of Bob Woodward, who was a Washington Post reporter who had been a naval intelligence officer working in the White House, working in the Nixon White House. And then he shows up like a year later and he's this brand new reporter. He'd never been a journalist at all. He's a naval intel officer, the famous Bob Woodward we all revere, and he's at the Washington Post, and somehow he gets the biggest story in the history of the Washington Post. He's the lead guy in that story. Well, I worked at a newspaper. I've been in the news business my whole life. That is not how it works. You don't take a kid like his first day from a totally unrelated business and put him on the biggest story. But he was. He was that guy. And who is his main source for Watergate? Oh, the number two guy at the FBI. Oh, so you have the naval intelligence officer working with the FBI official to destroy the president. Okay, so that's a deep state coup. What else? How would you describe that? If that happened in Guatemala, what would you say? And yet the way it was framed and the way that I accepted for decades was, oh, this intrepid reporter fought power. No. This intrepid reporter, Bob Woodward, was a tool of power, secret power, which is the most threatening kind, to bounce the single most popular president in American history, Richard Nixon, from office before the end of his term and replace him with who? Oh, Gerald Ford, who sat on the Warren Commission. Now, how did Gerald Ford get to be Richard Nixon's vice president? Well, because Carl Albert, the Democrat Speaker of the House, told him, you must choose him. We will only confirm him when they sent the actual elected vice president away for tax evasion, Spiro Agnew of Maryland. So you have a complete setup, like an absolute... Gerald Ford, the only unelected president in American history, actually sat on the Warren Commission. Something else that I accepted at face value until I looked at it, and I was like, that's completely insane. You didn't want to interview Jack Ruby in your investigation of the assassination? Okay, you're fake. Yeah, he was on the Warren Commission. And so, sorry for the long story, but the point is, like, that happened in front of all of us, but the way it was framed cloaked the obvious reality of it. The people who broke into the Watergate office building, from which the name is taken, Watergate, was, I think it was six of them or seven of them, all but one was a CIA employee. That's real. It's like, look it up on Google. So the whole thing, Richard Nixon was elected by more votes than any president in American history in the 1972 election. He was the most popular by votes, which is the only way we can really measure popularity, the most popular president in his reelection campaign. And 2 years later, he's gone. Undone by a naval intel officer, the number two guy at the FBI, and a bunch of CIA employees. You tell me what that is. Those are the facts. Those are not disputed facts. That's not crackpot.
They're not all the facts. I mean, G. Gordon Liddy was a FBI agent, a former supervisor of the FBI's D.C. office. I think the youngest one at like 30. The other fact is that Richard Nixon set up the Special Investigations Unit that ultimately, green-lighted the plumber's operation and the break-in at Watergate. So Richard Nixon was involved in a conspiracy to depose Richard Nixon?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also text us on our text line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And Ben Shapiro talked about this, too. I don't often invoke Ben Shapiro. I know a lot of people like him, but I generally find most of his stuff rather pedestrian.
The kids love him still. I don't get it. High schoolers love Ben Shapiro.
Well, whatever. He's a smart guy and all that. I don't invoke him much because I don't think there's anything particularly interesting there. It's just very, I don't know, sort of straightforward conservative boilerplate. But he responded to some of what Tucker said in this interview with Rogan, and I thought his response was on point because it didn't stop there. I mean, you know, just in those instances, you have, I mentioned, you didn't hear it, but it's there. 9/11, now Watergate, and by implication, his riff on Gerald Ford there, somebody other than Lee Harvey Oswald responsible for the JFK assassination, not exactly a novel belief, I understand, but I'm putting this in context here because it's not a one-off. Like, I've really looked at this, and I specifically think this. And I think here's what was left out. And I think the manifest weight of the evidence tends to push us in this direction and this specific matter. No, it's everything. It's JFK. It's Watergate. It's 9/11. It's World War II. And a really interesting take on the A-bomb and Truman's decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, this is not what you're about to hear is not the America firstism of the isolationists of the late 30s and early 40s.
The wildest thing about Tower 7 is that if you just say it looks like a controlled demolition, people get mad at you.
Why?
Well, I don't know.
Well,
because I'm not saying that it is a controlled demolition, but I'm saying if you watch it, it looks like a controlled demolition.
But that happens all the time. Buildings catch fire and they just implode in on themselves. I think it happens every week, right? All these poultry plants and manufacturing plants that keep getting burned through fire, they all like...
It's the way it went down.
Yeah. So... I say, why do they respond that way? And, of course, I responded that way. And I think looking back, the reason that I did was because if you call that into question, you had to ask a lot of other really obvious questions that you didn't want to deal with. And you might arrive at the conclusion that a lot of your most basic assumptions are false and that you've been had. And it's just too destabilizing, maybe.
Right.
Well, he goes on. It wasn't there. But he goes on to talk about America's war crimes. And he includes the firebombings, Dresden, and obviously the A-bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki as examples of that. He said the same thing or something very similar when he appeared on Russell Brand's podcast.
And I do think there are war crimes that the United States committed during the Second World War, the firebombing of Tokyo, famously Dresden, that were a collective punishment. And I would also say, by the way, the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that's collective punishment.
Yes.
Okay? And I think that rotted the soul of the West. I think that's so immoral that it did two things. One, you know, you carry the burden of sin at scale like that. You just do. You can't help it. And two, that level of power in the hands of human beings convinced them that they were gods.
Steve, Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, as an aside, Bomber Harris was behind that Dresden bombing. You can't say that that was an American deal. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
It gets
He's talking about the West and his examples, and then he moves over to Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, with all the people we would have lost if we'd invaded Japan, you know. What difference does it make whether you kill somebody with an atomic bomb or you just kill them by shooting them? You know, I mean, they're still dead. Anyways, it gets even deeper, all right? Gordon Liddy was a field agent in Gary, Indiana back in the 50s, and he lived in the same house in Lake Station, Indiana, that a foreman that I used to work with at U.S. Steel lived in. Now, that's pretty scary.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. I was on G. Gordon Liddy's show several times.
Here we go
When he had a radio show.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was fun. He's wild.
How long ago was that?
Oh, I don't know. Decades?
Decades ago?
Okay. I mean, there's more to this, and I particularly want to get to the World War II thing, but we're out of time on this because Steve from Northwest Indiana was starting to go there. It's just, you know, I get it. Somebody texted that. Where's that text? Somebody texted, when everything is a lie and the government promotes the lies, people turn to conspiracy theories to try to make sense of the lies. Yeah, I understand that, but that's not a defense. I mean, again, is that intellectually robust just to have that knee-jerk reaction? And when there are, you know, other explanations or other questions that should be asked and answers should be contemplated. He's just far afield for me, particularly on what he said about World War II, but even on some of the other stuff where there are real gaps in the threads that he is attempting to weave together into a tapestry of some sort. Well, into a tapestry of this conspiracy and that conspiracy and everywhere a conspiracy. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
It's time for In-Depth History with Frank, the history teacher from Arlington Heights, because there's nothing new in this world. It's just the history we don't know. Take it away, Frank.
Good morning. In 1940, the Democrats are facing a serious challenge to their 10-year run controlling Congress. The Depression was still on and war was raging in Europe. Time for a change. But it was young Representative Lyndon Johnson who was put in charge of the DCCC, and his incredible energy and connections to the deep pockets of the Texas oil industry led to a monumental comeback, with the party actually gaining 12 seats in the House. This 77th Congress was the one to declare war on the Axis powers in 1941. There were a few months of bipartisan cooperation after Pearl Harbor, but by the summer of 1942, the Congress was deeply unpopular. The rationing, travel restrictions, draft exemptions, and higher taxes all took their toll. People really got upset, though, when this Congress voted itself a generous pension for the first time. In response, a food and clothing drive called the Bundles to Congress was organized to help those poor, needy legislators. So in November 1942, a peeved electorate returned an extremely divided Congress, with the Dems holding a mere 5-seat majority, which over time dwindled to 2. Leading this rickety ramshackle was Speaker Sam Rayburn of Bonham, Texas. And Mr. Sam's skills got sharpened as he was able to lead the Congress to pass and keep mum about a $1.6 billion unnamed add-on to military spending. I'm talking about the Manhattan Project, which permanently changed the world, for better or worse. The cost rose to $2 billion over time, and as such, there were quiet but persistent demands to produce, with some historians asserting that this pressure partly influenced Truman's actual usage of Little Boy and Fat Man. Now, our current Speaker, Mike Johnson, also has a very slim congressional majority and faces major problems. He should look to Sam Rayburn for guidance.
Very good, Frank.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. State Senator Linda Holmes, out of Will County. Thank you, Will County. She has proposed making Illinois, I think it would be the 11th state to legalize assisted suicide, getting the medical profession in the business of killing people on purpose.
Yeah, just if they don't feel good, if they're depressed. I want to die. Okay, sure. Just tell us the date and time.
Well, that's what's happening in some other countries. That's not, of course, what's contained in the legislation in Illinois, because you don't start at the bottom of the slippery slope. You start at the top. You make it as sanitized as possible and hope people don't ask the questions about, could this set precedents? Does this leave open doors where we could slide down into a place where we are indulging people's mental afflictions and ending their lives under that guise or on that basis? Well, Linda Holmes, the state senator, said she decided to sponsor this legislation because of the suffering her parents went through as they battled cancer. And I understand that. It's terrible. Nobody wants to see their parents suffer. Nobody wants to see themselves suffer in particular, and they're clearly, people are thinking when they see somebody in a terribly difficult state, gosh, I hope that never happens to me. If that happens to me, I would want it ended. I want somebody to pull the plug. All the conversations that people have had. But is that fear a good basis to make wide sweeping public policy? I mean, we're seeing it right now in Chicago over the last year with Steve McMichael's battle, with ALS.
Right.
Of course, it's terrible. You don't wish that on anybody. Nobody would want that to happen to them or loved or really anybody else. And so you see that kind of suffering, the atrophying of the body and the mind is still there. For example, you say, gosh, I would never want to be in that state. I'd want somebody to end it. Or I'd want to be able to end it, or I'd want to be able to end it on behalf of a loved one in that case. And so it's a difficult decision to wrestle with and a difficult debate to have because it sounds compassionate to have that reaction.
You should put it in your will, what you want to have happen.
Fair enough. But in terms of the larger policy debate, it sounds compassionate. But is it really? Is that the compassionate way to contemplate the matter? For more on the answer to that question, please be joined by Wesley Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning, Chicago.
So what do you say to Senator Holmes, the sponsor of the assisted suicide legislation here, Death with Dignity, of course, it's the terrible suffering my parents went through as they battled cancer to the end, and that's what inspired me to sponsor this legislation, and looking at the experience of other states, particularly on the West Coast, the time has come.
Well, you always hear this kind of story when they want to push it, and they push it through fear-mongering. But if you take a look at the statistics of people who commit assisted suicide or who are euthanized, and this is pretty clear across the countries, It's not about pain and suffering. It's about fear, existential fear, fear of losing dignity, fear of being a burden. That's a really big thing. And so you find that also that, you know, the promise is always, well, we'll have strict guidelines to protect against abuse. Then as soon as the law becomes enacted, the supposed guidelines are redefined as obstacles, and you begin to see that kind of liberalizing expansion of the law. Assisted suicide is not about terminal illness. It's about killing as an answer to suffering. And once you decide that killing is an answer to suffering, the types of suffering that can eventually qualify for killing are almost endless. And that's why you see in places very close to Chicago, like in Canada, where you have people with disabilities being euthanized. You have people who can't get good access to medical care being euthanized. In fact, that's a big issue here. We're told that the very doctors who are unable to properly care for people because of resource issues or access issues should also be trusted to help kill people. It makes no sense.
Well, it just seems so barbaric. And all of this started in Europe. They've been doing this for a long time.
Well, the Netherlands has been doing it for many years, for decades, literally. They formally legalized it in 03. And in the Netherlands, you've seen the trajectory. They've gone from killing the terminally ill to the chronically ill to the elderly who are, quote, tired of life, to people with disabilities, to the mentally ill. People become, once you legalize assisted suicide, once you're a killable caste, C-A-S-T-E, people become objectified. So you see organ harvesting conjoined with euthanasia in places like Netherlands, Belgium, and in Canada. In Canada, in fact, it's so bad that in Ontario, if you qualify for euthanasia, the doctor calls the Organ Donation Society, and then they call you and say, can we have your liver? I mean, that's how bad it's become. And so once you open this door, it expands continually. Almost every state in this country, which is much more constrained than, say, Canada, because the people have not adapted it or adopted it widely like they have in Canada. But California has expanded the law. Oregon has expanded the law. Oregon allows non-residents, and so does Vermont, to have assisted suicide. What is the Oregon state interest in allowing somebody from Utah to come and have assisted suicide? There isn't any, because it's an ideological agenda. And eventually it becomes about money in the healthcare system.
Well, I mean, one way to deal with that organ harvesting situation is to do what I do, which is to live a life such that all your organs are unusable by anyone else.
Nobody wants your liver.
So, yeah.
But that would open you to medical experimentation. We got to figure all this out.
Yeah, we can clean that up.
For sure. I'm sort of tired of life, too, but I'm going to marshal on. I feel like I'm charged to. So in Canada, you said this eventually goes to money, too. I get that, you know, and older people, I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to lose my dignity. Before we get to the money thing, well, what about that? If somebody who's, in their 90s and we're running out of money, I don't want to rely on the kids and grandkids. I don't want to be a burden on the kids and grandkids. I'm done with life. I don't want to live anymore. I can't really get around it. You know, all of the things that you hear and say, okay, I'm ready. So, and you say what to the person in that situation or to the family of the person in that situation?
Well, in that situation, as we would with anybody who's suicidal, the answer is suicide prevention. I mean, we used to understand that when and elderly people do get depressed, there are actually specialists who can help with that, who can help elderly people overcome that depression. Often it's because of loneliness and isolation. The answer to loneliness and isolation is to help people not be lonely and isolated. It isn't to give them poison pills to kill themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that seems pretty straightforward.
If I said, look, Dan, I'm suicidal, you'd say, oh, come on, let's get the suicide prevention in. Let's make sure you don't jump off the bridge. And then I say, but I have cancer. And you say, oh, well, that's different. Here, let me hold your coat. I mean, it really is an isolating and abandoning ethic that says to some people, yes, your lives aren't worth living, but other people, well, we'll try to protect you from suicide.
So what do you say? Look, Wesley, at the end of the day, I hear what you're saying. And yes, I don't want people to kill themselves. But if they've made the decision It's their body, their choice. It's their personal autonomy. I respect your decision, so on and so forth.
Well, this is, you know, nobody's death is isolated. This affects how society views people. This affects how society views the importance of life. Suicide is, people, all of us, I could be dead in 5 minutes if I wanted to be from here. But we're not talking about suicide. We're talking about a joint enterprise to make someone dead, assisted suicide, enabling doctors to help kill people. Well, why should doctors be able to help kill people? They're not, all they're doing is giving people an overdose of drugs. It really is an issue that people embrace because of stories like this legislator. But I have stories, too, that show how very awful this agenda is. So we have to not only run on emotion and on stories, but what will this cause? Where will this lead? And what will happen? Again, in Canada, there have been at least two people that I'm aware of, and this is reported by the Canadian media, who didn't want euthanasia. They wanted treatment for their cancer, but it took 9 months to get to an oncologist. And so instead they chose to be euthanized. Mm-hmm. That is the kind of thing that will happen if we continue with this, because the inertia, if you will be towards getting sick and expensive and hard to care for people out of the way.
Well, yeah, particularly if the Western countries continue to get poorer by their own hands and their own profligate spending policies, then we got to cut somewhere. And, you know, Medicare, particularly end-of-life care, is real expensive.
A Belgian health executive recently let it out of the bag, and he said, well, we really have to do this because these old people are a real drag on our society.
During Obamacare, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, Zeke Emanuel famously said, I want to be gone after 75, and, you know,
now
you should
75.
Follow me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it really changes people's attitudes towards each other, and it's very poisonous in that regard.
Yeah, everybody looking at each other. Is it time to go yet, Granny? But what about teenagers and young adults who want to kill themselves? Because there's a young lady, she's 28 years old, scheduled to die in May. And she was talking about it on Facebook, and she seems very normal to me, but she said she's suffering from debilitating depression. Do you think that, you know, the 10 states that have it here, that that's going to be acceptable someday?
Someday, yeah, because the logic is inescapable. I mean, the issue is suffering. The issue isn't whether you're dying. And mental illness can cause far more suffering than cancer, and for a far longer period of time. So once we say suffering, killing is an answer to suffering, there's no moral principle that would stop it at any particular point. In fact, in Germany now, the highest court in Germany has said there's a fundamental right to commit suicide. There's a fundamental, for any reason, not having to do with health, but just for whatever reason you want, and nobody can gainsay it. There's a fundamental right to be assisted in suicide, and there's a fundamental right to assist suicide. It's called death on demand, and that's the final destination of the euthanasia movement.
Just in terms of how slippery this slope is, tell us the story of the amputations in Quebec.
Well, this has to do with the transgender issue, and with an affliction called BIID, body identity integrity disorder. It's what comes after transgender. There's a cadre of patients who have a very anguishing condition where they believe, they obsess that, let's say, their left arm shouldn't be there. They identify as a quadriplegic. They identify as somebody who can't see. And this has been known for a period of time. Not a lot of people have it, but people do have it. Well, the answer is beginning to be said, as with the transgender social craze, that, oh, instead of trying to help people keep their arms, let's cut them off for them. And in Quebec, there was this fellow with BIID, and he believed that two of his fingers did not belong on his hand. And the treatment, quote-unquote, was to cut them off, cut off healthy fingers. There's been another case of a woman who obsessed on being blind, and her psychologist poured caustic substances in her eyes. So if everything is subjective, if everything becomes about feelings, we have to accede to feelings, even beyond what should be a professional duty to do no harm, then there's no moral principle that would stop it anywhere. And so it's very interesting that the people with this condition are beginning to call themselves transable. Get it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right.
Because I think
because they'll be celebrated. Yeah, because they'll be celebrated. Oh, part of the trans community. They'll be included.
Exactly. And this fellow who had his fingers cut off, the media did a big celebration of it. Because, you know, it's whatever people want. Well, sometimes what people want is very destructive to themselves and to the culture generally.
Yeah. And for those people listening, you know, and you think that, you know, you've had all the conversations that we've talked about, and you've thought about these things, you say, well, it's a compassionate thing. Oh, the suffering is so bad, just in these isolated cases. And, you know, I would never support having a doctor cut off somebody's fingers because they thought their fingers didn't belong. That's where we draw the line. You don't get it. Once you erase lines, you don't get to redraw them. Once you give in to the sentimentalism, you don't get to put any governor on it. It is gone. And we've seen this in identity politics, and this is just sort of the latest extension of it, as you're describing, Wesley.
Yeah, there's no end point as far as I can see. And what happens when the fellow then says, well, you know, I actually shouldn't have a left elbow. You know, what are we going to just start hacking people up? I mean,
we're far too civilized for that. We could never engage in this kind of barbarism, and yet all around us, people see barbarism that they can't believe we're engaged in. So, if you don't think this is real, I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, if anyone who says that can't happen here has been asleep for the last 50 years.
Wesley Smith, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thank you for joining us again.
Always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, that was fun. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House law for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank, gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And that theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. This pronouncement from the fifth floor, Mayor BLM Brandon, announcing that his vision for a Gimme Dat Chicago has financing today. That was last week. We passed our $1.25 billion bond ordinance, which will bring transformative investments to Chicago neighborhoods with critical assistance for new businesses, cultural centers, affordable homes, and neighborhood and workforce development. He's bringing it all under the city's umbrella.
A better, stronger, safer Chicago.
Who is lining up to buy BLM Brandon bonds? That's what I want to know. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Ed, are you there?
Good morning, guys. Good morning, guys.
Are you staking out some of those bonds for all these transformative investments? This is how we invest in people, said BLM Brandon.
I want some of those in my portfolio. Yeah, no, there's going to be demand. There's always demand for Chicago bonds and Illinois bonds because we pay
yield.
The highest interest rates.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, yield. And people are hungry for it. Of course, less so than it was in the past when rates were zero. So now, Chicago competes with other places, and so maybe it'll be a little tougher. But they'll find buyers. But I think the real problem is going to be is that this is like, if I could convince anybody, if I could convince people, this is a horrible thing to do. The more power over such critical infrastructure things in the power of Brandon Johnson and the city council's hands is sad. You know, I think we run the risk of them taking the next steps, and we've talked about that LaSalle Street and. and others, they're going to try to do things in their vision, and their vision is highly flawed, as I think we've talked about.
City-owned housing, city-owned, essentially, or financed businesses. You know, it's funny because all he's doing is what's being proposed by his fellow travelers at the federal level. Last week, an op-ed from Comrade Bernie and AOC, the front girl for the Socialist Spice Girls, announcing our Green New Deal for public housing. That is a win-win-win. That's a triple win. That's not a twofer. It's a threefer. Win-win-win for America. Here's why. The U.S. has lost 1 in 4 public housing units to privatization, demolition, and underfunding over the last decade. Need to shore that up. Put those towers back, Ted, and retrofit some of those office buildings in the financial district. Similarly, so that we win-win-win for the people.
Yeah, I think it's a sad state. And, you know, we've talked a lot about how Chicago is already at the bottom of the barrel nationally. If you look at the Case-Shiller index, which you know has the value of property in Chicago, and if you look at the last 20 years, there's one city that stands out above all the others when you're talking about the 20 largest cities in the country, and that's Chicago. It'll be at the bottom of the list for home growth, home value growth, and that's a lot of that has to do with failed policies, and now we're going to have guys and gals who think that they can do better than the markets. And that's been the problem in Chicago, is we got people who are smarter than the markets, and they will continue to make a mess of downtown.
And what about the migrant situation? I mean, $70 million was voted by the city council, not without some pushback from like Alderman Lopez, Alderman Beal. But where is that money coming from, Ted?
Oh, geez, it's the same money. You know, all you got to do is borrow $1.25 billion and you got money. I think what's interesting about the whole migrant crisis, and they're getting a little smarter if you follow the news, they want to combine the homelessness approach by combining the traditional Chicagoans for homelessness with the migrants and create one pool and one management source, so that way they're not creating the envy between the two. So that's the kind of... that's a kind of smart quote. I put that between quotes. Smart action they're going to take to eliminate or try to eliminate some of the animosity between groups is lump them all together.
It's bringing people together.
That works.
That's harmonizing.
Yeah, bring people together.
That is wonderful. Bringing people together around the same trough. I mean, that's what we do in Chicago best we can. Sometimes the trough isn't as big as it needs to be. You got to get a bigger trough.
Yep. Well. Which brings us to the 9% raises that Chicago Teachers Union wants. People thought that was a max. So the Chicago Teachers Union is negotiating a new contract, probably a 4-year contract, maybe 5. And in there, they want new salaries and new benefits. And of course, with Brandon Johnson in the seat there, the opposition in theory should be very limited to what the CTU wants. And so they want 9% minimum raises per year. And on top of that would be other stuff. 9% raises per year for the next 4 years. I mean, imagine that. I mean, I would love a guaranteed 9% raise a year.
Well, I hope that was just
that in their contract.
Yeah. I thought that was just a starting point. But they really want is $2,000 per illegal child that is now in the classroom. So anyone here, because they need to fill the classrooms, but they also are going to give them a benefit.
That's on the institutional side. But first we get paid. Then the system gets paid. Yeah. Let's keep the rank order priority right. Yeah. No, it's cool. Hey, well, say, what's the problem? Say, Davis case. And so what they want 36% over 4 years? And so what they want $2,000 per kid of an illegal in this city, in this country? So what? So what are you going to do about it?
We're going to pay it.
Yeah, or they'll strike. As they said this, they're still keeping the possibility of a strike open.
And they want housing, too, for CPS employees who can't afford to live in this city.
Damn straight.
Well, then get a second job. A lot of people have second jobs.
No.
The teachers, I know.
These are educators. They're singularly focused. They're all artists. And as such, you know, the fact that they're the highest paid teachers adjusted for cost of living in the country, they need to be higher still.
Oh,
that's how it is.
What goes unsaid is that starting teachers have the highest starting salary in the country, as you just said, over $60,000. I mean, if you're a young person starting at CPS and making over $60,000, I mean, that's that's pretty good compared to people who move into advertising or something like that. Who are
pretty good.
Well, you have 16 weeks off a year, too.
Pretty good ain't good enough. These are advertising, finance, the financial services. What are you talking about? These are people that are educating the next generation of our kids. There is no more important job. They should all be making as much as Ken Griffin used to make when he was in Chicago. You can't put a price tag on educating kids, Ted, Amy. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you hate teachers.
I don't hate teachers.
You do?
No, I don't. I love
you. Do
I love
you
my
do?
Son's teachers. They were
nope.
Great. And they
nope.
Cared.
Not if you don't write a blank check. You don't like teachers. That's what I've learned.
Right, if you complain about the results, you hate teachers, right? So it's I like to say it's hard to blame any one group because it's so damn, you know, it's so bad that you have to blame everybody who touches the system. So, administrators, everybody.
Yeah, with respect to the migrant kids in school, you know, I look at this. I mean, you know, people look at this in a negative light.
I try to be
because you're not welcoming like I am.
I'm very welcoming.
I'm more welcoming, and let me tell you how welcoming
tell
I am.
Tell me, and I'll tell you how I'm welcoming.
I'm looking at this like the college portal. All we're doing is we've established a portal, and we're transferring in K-12 students from Central and South America and Eastern Europe and anywhere else from where they would like to move to come to Chicago. We're just transferring them in so that we can fill these slots because as I see from WirePoint, the number of more than half empty schools in Chicago has doubled over the past decade. Fill these slots so the properly paid teachers, once they get the 36% raise, can impose their artistry on kids the world over. And now we're not just making it rain for Chicago's kids. We're doing it globally. How do you like that?
I do like the portal mentioned because we have a lot of Illinois kids who've entered the portal and gone to Texas and Tennessee and Florida. So we have these half empty schools. You know, we used to have 75 of the Chicago schools that were half empty or more. It's doubled to 163 schools. So like you say, we need people to fill those schools because they're empty.
Uprising has 51 students and 52 teachers. Yeah.
Well,
so I heard they're getting a lot of the migrants phenomenal. There.
Yep. Absolutely. That's why
one-on-one's just a little boring for the
Well,
teachers.
First of all, that's the proper ratio. So okay. We need more students and more teachers and wraparound services. Mm-hmm. You need language support. You need financial planners. You need attorneys, real estate agents, all for each kid. You need like the full complement of professional services that anybody might need coming to Chicago. We'll pick up, by the way, too. We'll pick up the real estate agent's commission too on any home they want to purchase with city assistance. I think that's only fair.
Right.
I mean, let's do this. Let's do this right. Let's do this big, like Stacey Davis Case wants. But by the way, I saw that Springfield offered this sort of pro forma, you know, I stood up to Chicago bulljive vote. Some no confidence vote in BLM Brandon and Stacey Davis Gates about what they want to do to eliminate selective enrollment schools. No. We're going to vote against that to show how we're, you know, if you're not a Chicago legislator, how we're standing up to Chicago. If you are, we're standing up to the teachers union. I mean, that's so contrived.
Oh, it was funny because I had some people call me and say, you know, that's good news. Why don't we cover that? And I said, wait a minute. The same people who are trying to protect the selective enrollment schools are the same ones who just killed Invest in Kids Act. Let's not forget that. So let's not jump up and down about these guys. This has more to do with internal battles than it does with the fact that these legislators are somehow now, you know, keen on choice.
And the people that said that to you, that, hey, this is good news, you should report on it. Those I bet are like center-right people, right?
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Because,
they you know, understand.
They want to find something good to celebrate.
Either they're just sort of given in to the delusion of wanting, like the rest of the state, and just tell me beautiful lies. Tell me there's hope, even if they're, tell me this is an instance of something to be hopeful about, even if it's not. Or they still still understand absolutely nothing about this political class and this political culture. It's just stunning.
Dan, they don't understand. And this is it. You know, they want to say, hey, we've got to say something good about what's going on. You know, because you know, Pritzker and the, you know, they actually did something good, and we should make sure we celebrate that and you know, cheer them on. Never mind that they'll, you know, they'll stab you in the back on the things that are really important, like investing kids. So it is, you know, the educational elite continue to be confused about what's good and what's bad.
Absolute willing, enthusiastic participants in their own and their community's destruction. I mean, under-discussed story is what we and the right or center right don't do. I mean, what does it take? We talk about getting through to BLM Brandon or the teachers union or union rank and file. We can't even get through to people who are similarly disposed.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, and what people forget in this bill is that in addition to blocking the selective enrollment school closings, is the legislators actually, you know, appease the unions by saying you can't close down empty schools either. So,
of course,
you know, the unions got what they wanted, right? Because that was part of it. You know, originally, the bill was don't close selective enrollment schools, and suddenly it became don't close selective enrollment schools or all these empty schools. So there you go.
I feel like I'm in line. You know, the movie Airplane, where that woman gets hysterical and a line forms,
yeah.
Like somebody tries to slap her out of it. And then other people in line have like a tire iron and a pipe and a baseball bat. I think that's what we need. I think we need a line. And those people who call you and who fit that profile, you know, treat them like the hysterical woman in the Airplane movie. I don't know what else will work.
It's really good. That's really good. It's exactly that. You know, we keep slapping her in the face and it doesn't work. So we go to the next one. It doesn't work. Good.
Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks as always, Ted.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560. The Answer.
All right, let me squeeze this in here because I keep teasing it. John Wayne Bobbitt, he lost another body part. He lost a few of his toes. So not only did his ex-wife cut off his penis, and it was surgically reattached, by the way, in 1993. He now has lost a few toes, and he blames it on the water at Camp Lejeune. And he says that oil and the industrial wastewater that was dumped into the storm drains may have played a part in his toxic relationship with Lorena, his then wife. So,
how's his penis doing?
I don't know. It's attached, so that's good news.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Bidenflation, what people, it's not people don't understand it as much as politicians don't understand it. They don't understand then why people don't understand it. I guess they're somewhat insulated from the vagaries of having to pay for food and fuel, as our friend Scott the Cow Guy Shelley likes to say, food and fuel. And food and fuel is where American families have been taken in the pants over the last 3 years. Wages not keeping up with price increases, and people who are not insulated from economic reality feel those things because they got less money to spend to get by on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And so like your goldfish threshold case of how much is a bag of goldfish?
It's a box of goldfish, Dan, and it started out at $4.86 when Trump was in office, and it's now $11.98, and that is sickening. But it's hitting every part of America. Here's a reporter from Billings, Montana. This is good stuff.
Visit just about any restaurant or store, and you'll hear people talking about inflation. And the Evergreen Cafe inside this Billings Ace Hardware store is no exception.
Our food costs have increased by about 175%. Everything from dairy, especially meat and poultry, has been a huge factor. Grocery items such as fruits and vegetables.
Andrew Lochner and his wife have owned this cafe for the past 2 years and have seen the costs go up significantly. That's one reason the business played host to a roundtable discussion on the topic held by Senator Steve Daines.
I think some of these massive spending and tax bills contribute to what's going on with the inflation.
According to the senator's office, the consumer price index rose 3.5% in March, and inflation has been on the rise significantly ever since COVID. According to the Joint Economic Committee, the average Montana household has spent $26,000 more due to inflation since January of 2021. Breaking down the numbers even further, that equates to $253 more dollars a month on housing, $141 more per month on energy costs, and $142 a month more on food.
Yeah, food and fuel. We need to get those I Did That stickers that used to populate gas pumps around America and start having restaurants put them on their menus next to the pricing. Grocery stores put them on their products. For more on this, please be joined by Robert Posen. He's a senior lecturer at the MIT Sloan School of Management, former chairman of MFS Investment Management as well. Robert Posen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Dan.
So it's, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit. I don't think you need to explain it to ordinary Americans as much as, yes, inflation has come down. So what you're seeing is prices increasing at a slower rate, but they're still increasing. Biden doesn't seem to understand that, and his miscommunication leads to a misunderstanding of what the American people understand.
Yeah, I think the problem is that the economists are focused on a very narrow set of numbers. They're looking at what's happened over the last year, and inflation over the last year has subsided, but it's still 3.5% for the year. But as you say, the normal consumer doesn't just say, okay, what happened during the last year? They're looking at price level over the last few years. And if we look at price levels over the last 3 years, ending January 2024, prices on all items were up around 18%. Now, of course, we see that some economists want to take out food and fuel, and I agree with you. It's crazy to take out food and fuel because people have to pay for it. But even if you took out food and fuel, prices over 3 years would still be up over 16%. And that's what I think people look at. They don't look at what just happened narrowly in the last year. They look at what happened over the last several years, and then they compare it to what happened to their pay. Well, the average pay over the last 3 years went up around 15.3%. And that's not take-home pay. That's before tax. And, of course, there's withholding for Medicare and Social Security at 14.3%. So that 15.3% wage increase isn't really what it seems. Because, again, people look at what they actually got in their take-home pay and they compare it to what they had to pay for these goods and services several years ago. So I think the economists have it all wrong. They're looking at this very narrowly and not understanding the very common sense view that most consumers have.
Right. They're practical. Like, food and fuel. It's not just I got to pay for it. It's I got to pay for it to live. Some other things I can do without, but I can't do without food and fuel.
Yeah. The other thing is it's the price level, not the rate of increase. The rate of increase over the last year has been, say, 3.1 to 3.5%. But that's not what people look at. They think, look, I bought a tuna fish sandwich in the beginning of 2021, and I paid takeout $10 for the sandwich. Now that sandwich cost me like $12.80. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot more. The 3% is like irrelevant. And then, of course, when you go to get a takeout these days, people want a tip, even for a takeout. Oh, okay. So, of course, you got to increase that. So your tuna sandwich that used to be $10 a share, $10 a sandwich, is now $13. And that's a big increase. And it's irrelevant that prices only went up by 3%. The question is, what's the price level from several years ago as compared to today. That's what consumers look at, and that's what economists are missing.
Well, I got to tell you, I got an oil change yesterday, and last time I got my oil change, it was $62, $77. And I said, "What? It's the same product." He goes, "Everything is going up. Everything is more expensive. We have not increased our labor costs to do it." But I mean, they keep chipping away and chipping away. So how do we make America affordable again?
Well, I think that's a difficult question, but we first need to change expectations here, because we've gotten ourselves into an inflationary spiral, and the Fed was very late in fighting it. So I think the Fed's going to have to keep interest rates up for a little while longer and really start to bring down people's expectations. People for a long time thought interest rates would be at zero. Now that's changed. And so we've got to change the whole dynamic here. And we've got to accept a little slower growth and maybe a little higher unemployment to get inflation expectations back to normal. We're way off the chart because the Fed was very late in combating inflation, and now we're fighting a rearguard action.
Well, the other thing, too, is all these wondrous investments that the administration is touting to transform our economy, they're not paying dividends for American people. They're not even paying dividends to the rent seekers that they're underwriting. Wall Street Journal had it yesterday. Despite billions of dollars in subsidies over the last few decades, more energy products still failing to launch. On Friday, three New York offshore wind projects hit the rocks owing to rising costs and technical snafus. The New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, one of these industrial policy outposts, called off contract negotiations with three wind developers after turbine manufacturer GE Vernova said it couldn't deliver 18 megawatt turbines for the project. So this powering our $23 trillion economy on wind and solar panels that transformation isn't happening quite as seamlessly as advertised.
Well, I think that's while those facts are true, this is all the money that goes into that energy infrastructure now is just starting, and the money going into chips. So a lot of that money is being spent in the United States. Exactly what's going to come about that, I don't think we know yet. So it's unclear, I think, whether those expenditures are going to be productive or not. I just think the jury's still out on that.
So with respect to fiscal and monetary policy, you mentioned Jay Powell and the Fed. You heard Senator Daines on that clip mentioned the profligate fiscal policies of the executive and congressional branches, legislative branches of government. You know, Milton Friedman, of course, famously said inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Is that still operative, or is it a at this level of profligacy on both the fiscal and monetary sides, is it a combination of the two?
Well, right now we have tight monetary policy, so we don't have
that came after profligate.
After a long time. And in Congress, both sides are willing to spend a huge amount of money on a wide variety of things. So we've got to combine what we have now, which is stricter monetary policy, with some fiscal constraints, and that takes both parties' willingness to cut back on spending. And so far, we haven't seen that. And it's in the context of Social Security and Medicare going way up, and now interest on the national debt's going up. And then, of course, we have these increasing obligations in foreign countries to help fight the war in Ukraine, to fight off Russia. So we're facing many fiscal obligations that we can't get rid of. So we need to be much more careful about adding on any new obligations. But that would require discipline on part of both Democrats and Republicans. And so far, we haven't seen that very well.
No, we haven't. Robert Posen is a senior lecturer at the MIT Sloan School of Management, former chairman of MFS Investment Management as well. Robert Posen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you know how you said you're feeling old?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't feel old. I am older.
Right. You're about to feel older still.
Uh-huh.
Molly Ringwald. You remember Molly Ringwald?
Oh, yes. 16 Candles, Breakfast Club. You know, I never saw 16 Candles the entire way through, but I did see Breakfast Club a million times. I love that movie. Because the last scene, he's walking.
Spoiler alert.
He's walking across the football field at Glenbrook South High School.
Oh, gosh.
And I was right by our house, so we watched that scene.
We're such
80s people.
Yeah, I mean, we're such hicks.
Lucas was at Glenbard West. He walked across Glenbrook South's football field, blah, blah, blah.
Lame. Anyway.
Well, that was a big deal back then. I mean, to have a film, you know, shot in Chicago area, Home Alone 2, all of that. And John Hughes was great because he, you know, brought all that to us. And he was a very nice man. He always asked for my mom whenever he went to Spalding and Company Jewelers at Northbrook Court. He was a regular customer, so thank you for helping the family.
Wow.
I met him, too. He's a very nice man. But he always asked for my mom. Louise always asked for her.
Nobody did coming-of-age films in the 80s better than John Hughes. I agree. How about Pretty in Pink? How about Pickup Artists? Did you see those? Anyway, Molly Ringwald recently commented on whether those movies that brought her stardom could be made today. Boy, we have that conversation a lot, don't we? Could something that happened 5 minutes ago be made today? Could The Office be made today? No. Could anything
Saddles
be made today? Could Seinfeld be made today? No.
Blazing Saddles? Heck no.
Well, of course not. Molly Ringwald had this to say about her oeuvre.
Those movies, the movies that, you know, I'm so well known for, they were very much of a time, you know, and if you were to remake that now, I think it would have to be much more diverse, and it would have to be, you couldn't make a movie that white now. No, those movies are really, really very white, and they don't really represent, what it is to be a teenager in a school in America today, I don't think. So, you know.
Is that something to applaud? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Yeah, in the remake of 16 Candles, Jake Ryan will be played by Dylan Mulvaney.
Long Duck Dong.
It's racist.
Why is it
There's
racist?
No Long Duck
that was
Dong.
His name. I mean, that's what they call him, right?
With the caricaturing and so on and so forth? No. Oh. Molly Ringwald's character.
Who should that be,
In 16 Candles?
Uh-huh.
Chaz Bono, maybe? Don't you think?
You know what? I could see it.
To represent America, the American high school experience as it is today. They were so white. Yeah, well, I don't know. Why were they so popular?
A lot of white people were in the suburbs back then. Now it's a lot more diverse.
I guess, but so what? So black kids go into suburban school districts, at least the ones that vaguely resemble what they were 30 or 40 years ago, they can't relate to, prom and the cliques in high school and so on and so forth. Really, it's that different? What would it be then? What would make it more diverse? Fighting in the hallways?
Girl
fighting in particular? What is it that would be so like representative of a high school today that would be so much more positive? The sexualization of kids in classrooms, everybody sitting around reading, pick a title, any title, you know, we've gone through them all. The pride year at high schools. Oh, they were so white. Oh, really? So can I watch, oh, I don't know, Roots and take something away from that piece of artistry? Or I can't because I'm black, because I'm not black. Only black people can. Can I take something away from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Sidney Poitier? Sure I can, even though I'm a honky from the suburbs. That statement that everybody giggles at and applauds is ignorance celebrating ignorance. It's so white. Like, they were so awful. Really?
Last I checked, Molly Ringwald is white, so.
By the way, in terms of making you feel older than you already feel.
Oh, God, yeah, what do you got, boss?
How old do you think Jake Ryan is, the actor who played Jake Ryan?
Oh, dear Lord, 50? What?
He may even be a little older than you.
How old is he?
63.
Yeah, he's a lot older than me.
63. Jake Ryan is 63.
Old. Gene Hackman is 94 or 95. Did you see him recently?
Yeah. He's 94.
I know, but I don't want him to be 94. I want him to be as he was in Hoosiers.
Yeah, but I mean, he was early 50s in Hoosiers.
Right.
But he was a guy, I mean, if you go back and like look at the French Connection, I mean, for example, I mean, he's got so many films, such a, one of the great actors of all time, from Danville. He was a guy who looked like he was 50 when he was 30. And then he sort of looked like he was still in his 50s when he was 70. You know, so it's weird, you know? Yeah. I think it was the haircut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Because,
in The Firm, he was probably 70. Yeah. And he still looked like, he sort of looked like Coach Norman Dale. Dave in Ravenswood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I mean, that comment to me just shines a light on how the anti-racist is by nature racist because you're focused on race. It's a cycle, a feedback loop of humanity. They did the same thing in 2019 around Christmas. There were all these articles about the Rockettes, you know, that New York dance act about the Rockettes, so white, it's going to be a white Christmas. Why, when it comes to art, do we have to have this diversity? It's crazy. Would you ever imagine that group Boys to Men in the 90s, one of my favorite 90s bands, saying, well, it's not diverse enough. We need to throw in a couple of Mexicans, a white guy, and an Asian. That'll make it better. No, it wouldn't. It would ruin it. It's just crazy to me.
It is. Thanks for the call, Dave.
Got a text message. Shaft should have been played by Sly Stallone.
Yeah, exactly. Jim in Crown Point.
You know, why don't we have Roots, a remake, and the black people are the slave owners?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And how about, this one makes me sick.
Jordan Peele can make that movie, or maybe Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jim.
John Legend and Kelly Clarkson remade the Christmas song, Baby, It's Cold Outside, because it was a seductive song. They changed the words and everything.
Thanks for the call, Jim. All right. It's just an unfortunate comment. It just speaks to, like I said, it's the biggest thing is like a great story, a great piece of art doesn't have appeal beyond the racial composition of the cast. That's just so patently absurd.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, just thinking more about the conversation we were having about Molly Ringwald and her movies. And could you imagine a Puerto Rican American making a Broadway musical that serves as a biography of Alexander Hamilton, one of our honky founding fathers, featuring a cast of mainly minorities with leads being black actors and singers? Could you imagine that?
Oh, wait, we can because it was a reality.
I know, it's just so stupid. With arts, like with sports, these things that should be separate and distinct from the political winds of the day. Can you just focus on making good art and just stop polluting it with idiotic identitarian politics? Good grief. I mean, how many examples do we need to go through of art being transcendent of race, like sports is transcendent of race? It's just so dumb. Annoying. All right. Speaking of art, Patriots Fest. Patriots Fest kicks off in Aurora, Illinois.
Oh.
May 18th, 2024. So May 18th, next month, in Aurora. PatriotsFest.com is where you get tickets. It's hosted by Matt Pinfield. Boy, there's a name from the past. You remember Matt Pinfield on MTV?
That's Downtown Julie Brown going to be there too?
I don't know. I don't think so. But I think she's still on Sirius. So is Martha Quinn. Okay. And Matt Pinfield, remember he hosted the 120 Minutes, that alternative music show.
Yep.
It was pretty good. He was a bit of an odd looking dude. He actually looked like the horror film character Pinhead. A little bit. He did.
Okay.
Minus the pins. Anyway, features, it's a pretty good lineup here, I'd say. Three Doors Down.
That's good.
Ted Nugent.
Oh.
Motor City Madman.
I met him before.
Big and Rich. Bowling. Cowboy Troy.
Okay.
Brandon Hart. Creed Fisher.
Wow.
And many others. So it looks to be a quite a good show, quite a good music fest.
Bands, I actually know who they are, yes.
That's always helpful for, you know, older folk like you.
Okay, easy.
This is, by the way, the Patriots Fest, as the name sort of indicates, is organized to honor heroes that make this country great. And again, kicking off May 18th in Aurora, PatriotsFest.com is where you buy tickets. And tell us a little bit more about it. We're pleased to be joined by organizer and veteran himself, Phil Oakley. Phil, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you doing, Dan and Amy?
Good. We're doing well. Thanks for joining us. So tell us more about the genesis of Patriots Fest, the vision for it, and what fans have in store.
Excellent question. Patriots Fest was a concept. A friend of mine and a couple other military and folks that are involved in the music industry, we had been raising funds and, more importantly, awareness for veterans charities to help those that have been affected by their service for their loved ones. So we said, how can we put a show together on a bigger scale? We've been doing small ones of these in the D.C. area. How can we do it on a bigger scale and bring people to understand the sacrifices that men and women that have served have had over the years? So first thing we did was find a couple charities that I'm familiar with and work with. One of them, for example, it's called Special Ops Survivors. The funds go directly to the survivors of Special Ops individuals that have perished in combat. That charity I've worked with maybe 6 or 7 years and met many spouses of men who've fallen in combat. And so we got the idea to bring them together, and it's really an awareness. To me, Patriots Fest, if I were to sum it up in one sentence, it's a celebration of music and military accomplishment. So that's the background, I guess, on how we came up with the idea.
And this is rolling out in Aurora on May 18th, as we mentioned, but this is going to be coming to towns across the country, I presume?
Yes, we have four locations that have asked us to bring the event there, and we haven't finalized it, so we won't share it, but the initial kickoff is in Aurora. And what I'll say about that, in 1983, I was stationed at Fort Sheridan, just up the road from there. So when the opportunity to go there, I decided, let's do it there first, because that's when my military career started.
Well, it's hard to organize an event on this such a large proportion. How did you get all these big-name entertainers?
What we did was we reached out to them, and knowing that if you make it about the military, we're not hoping to make money off of this. We're hoping to make funds for these charities, but make this an awareness event. And that's why many of them jumped on right away. As you said, we have a pretty good lineup for our first event.
And just on the Ted Nugent, I mean, I just have to ask, any possibility of like winning a bow hunting excursion with Ted Nugent or something like that if you attend? You know, sort of a dream of mine.
I'll take that for action. Bow hunting with Ted.
Now, I see included in the lineup is Matt Oakley. Is that in a relation to Phil Oakley?
Yeah, he keeps telling me that I'm his father, but I haven't done the 23andMe yet.
Well, how did you get Matt Pinfield? Yeah. Speaking of Matt's, I mean, he used to host MTV, obviously.
Yeah, Matt's a legend. Matt is also a patriot, and he knows lots of people in the business, and one of the guys on our team has a relationship with him, picked up the phone, and he said, I'd love to do it. This is honoring veterans and raising awareness. So he jumped on board, and I'm excited to see him in Chicago, a.k.a. Aurora, celebrating the careers of all these distinguished military.
And it's and this is sort of a broad range of musical genres, right? I mean, you have like Three Doors Down, which is sort of, I don't know, I'd say top 40, you know, pop rock and country, and right? So it's a little bit, you're going to hear some different iterations of music.
Correct. The artists are diverse. What I would love to share is some of our military lineup, which we haven't even announced. Like, we started announcing it publicly. For example, we have a Medal of Honor winner who we're going to recognize, Colonel Doc Ballard. He was a corpsman in Vietnam and as a Marine, and later transitioned over to the Army, which is the better service, but we can understand why he did that. And we have General officers, we have Navy SEALs, we have Green Berets, we have Marine Force Recon, all of these very distinguished individuals who kind of operate under the radar. And most of them say, you know, I don't need to be recognized. And it's about acknowledging their service and making sure people understand the sacrifice and the commitments that they've made.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a Medal of Honor winner that is a friend of the show. We've talked to him from time to time, participated in some of his charitable events too, which Alan Lynch, probably familiar with him. He's a great, great dude too. I think he's still local if he hasn't absconded from Illinois.
We reached out to him. Unfortunately, he's busy that day. We have another local veteran, Richard Dick Miller, 97-year-old, who was in World War II. His ship was sunk, the Drexler, in Okinawa. And he's actually going to sing God Bless America at the event. So,
awesome.
How great is that? He's 96. He's about to turn 90. No, he's 97, about to turn 98.
So the combination, too, of recognizing and then educating, I like that. That's a little bit different. So just more detail about one of the organization that stands to benefit from this, America's Future, where you're, from what I understand, you know, this is the education piece, young people to appreciate those who serve, what those in the armed services do, and so forth.
Correct. Basically, the mantra is empowers young people to be active and curious citizens about building a freer community, at least to dignity and happiness for all. That's the tagline, you know. But working towards a time when Americans could collaborate to drive change in their communities. They have mentoring opportunities, leadership engagement, and a national network that with extensive programming that supports building a better America. And one of the things I try to explain to people, you know, this is not a political event. Some people have asked, it sounds like a rally. This is not a political event. Being patriotic has no political leaning. Everybody in America should be patriotic. And that's what we're hoping to get across in our messaging. Like back in World War II and World War I, after these campaigns, everybody was extremely patriotic. America was the only unifying thing that we cared about. Sure, we were different, but we were unified in the sense that we cared about America and keeping America safe and keeping America moving forward together, if you will.
If people want to fly Trump flags, I mean, can they fly flags there, or a Biden flag? Although I don't think I've ever seen a Biden flag. is that okay to do that?
Well, what I would say is we are flying the American flag, okay. For example. We have former special operations team called the Shooters that are going to be jumping in with the American flag during the concert. And there's another flag we have. It's called the Patriots Fest flag. But it's one unifying flag. We want everybody to be unified. We don't want, we don't want this to turn into them versus us. Being patriotic is one flag. So I would say, you can bring it in your car or whatever. You want to put it on your car in the parking. We're really promoting the American flag.
Your background in the music industry, you just mentioned in passing. I'm just curious what it is.
It's funny. As a staff sergeant stationed in Germany, I used to be a disc jockey at night. That really got me into how music can be unifying and a great thing to bring people together. And then I've been doing government contracting since I retired in 2005, and I have several government-related businesses. And I was in Nashville when all this turmoil was going on in the country, and I said, I'm going to launch a record company. My wife said, what do you know about that? I go, nothing, but I know about business. And so over the last 3 years, we've been working and building this small boutique, if you will, record company called C2 Records. And we've had millions of streams, and we're doing well for a small label, but I don't want the focus to be on the label. I want it to be on Patriots Fest.
So you're like an Adrian Cronauer, Good Morning Vietnam, famously played by Robin Williams. That was that was part of your time in the military?
Oh, that's too funny. But yeah, it was a disc jockey, but it was at a German disco. So I would start talking in German and then communicate with the Americans in English. And it was funny because the enunciations over there, I'd say, I'd ask them, come up if you want us to play a song, and they would say, kannst du auflegen wie die Oster?
It's such a beautiful language.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So romantic.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hach and och.
Yeah. Rolls off the tongue. So is there going to be a now this is the time on Sprockets when we dance portion of the program? Or
If you come there and you're willing to dance, I'm willing to put you up there, Dan, and you can dance the
Now
He's Sprockets.
I'd pay to see that. Yeah. Well, used to be a break dancer, right?
I did.
Around cardboard with you and parachute pants. And
I didn't quite make the cut for Electric Boogaloo. Past life. All right. So Patriot Fest, again, it's May 18th. It's in Aurora. It's at the Piazza in Aurora, right?
Correct. It's outside in the Piazza. We have everything blocked off. We have, I haven't even gone into it. We have lots of sponsors that are sending military. So if you're a former E6 and below, you can get on a list. Sponsors are buying tickets for veterans to go that are E6 and below. If you're above E6, you can afford a concert ticket that's going to charity. Just go online to the site, pass the word. If you've ever been on a military base when they have these big Memorial Day celebrations, just think of that with an amazing lineup of musicians. I mean, Three Doors Down, Ted Nugent, Bigger Rich, Cowboy Troy, Demon Jones, etc. These guys are legit, and they're doing it because they want to bring awareness and raise funds for our veterans' charities.
Okay, and it's hosted by Matt Pinfield of MTV fame. May 18th at Aurora at the Piazza. Get tickets, patriotsfest.com. Patriotsfest.com is where you get tickets. Phil Oakley, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the concerts.
Thank you so much. Hope to see you out there. Come on out, Patriots.
All right. Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.